Take up the white man's burden. Send forth the best ye breed. Go send your sons to exile to serve your captive's need, to wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half-devil and half-child. More than a century ago, when Rudyard Kipling wrote of the white man's burden, race was thought of as a biological fact, red and yellow, black and white. What have contemporary biologists discovered about race? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Year.
Is there such a thing as race at all? Is there a legal definition of race? What does contemporary genetics show about genetic variation among humans? And, well, how alike are we? Our guest is Pilar Osorio, professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison and ethics scholar at the Morgridge Institute for Research.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm guessing that when you speak on topics like race and genetics, that you know you're going into a room where people are going to find it controversial.
Yes, although it's interesting because usually I'm speaking to medical and scientific audiences, and it's not so much that they find it controversial as that they find it something they would prefer not to have to talk about. So we sometimes say, okay, now we're going to talk about the R word.
Really? But doesn't it pretty quickly break down into something much more complex than that?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I mean, I think that's one of the problems, if you will, is that people in the scientific community, you use these concepts, including race and ethnicity concepts, when they work, and you use them in ways that work for you. The problem is that those are also concepts in the broader community, in our larger society. So there may not be complete overlap between the way the scientists are using them and the popular notions of racial categories, for instance. And another problem is sometimes there is overlap and the scientists don't realize it. So sometimes people start out with a kind of more formal operational definition, but they quickly slide back and forth between a more formal definition that was designed for a specific research project or a specific medical intervention. And they kind of slide back and forth into the more popular notions without always realizing that that's happening.
Well, even when you're filling out forms where you have to check a certain box for race, it can be problematic. I have a student in my class right now who is a quarter African-American, a quarter Cuban, a quarter Laotian, and a quarter Blackfoot Indian. And there's no space. You know, I mean, what does race mean for a student like that?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's an incredibly interesting combination. And I'm sure I have a lot of friends who would love to DNA sequence that person. But many people who consider themselves Hispanic, that is a category that officially, administratively, on forms, and according to the Office of Management and Budget that puts forth these racial categories that are used on U.S. government forms, Hispanic is considered an ethnicity but not a race. And yet in parts of this country, I think we could say that Hispanic or Latino is a racialized category, and people who identify themselves as Hispanic or Latino don't necessarily think of themselves as some other race. And there are some funny stories of people in designing census forms. One of the things they discovered is that people who check the box other for race, something like over 90% of those people also identify themselves as Hispanic. And so they've tried to design those forms to sort of push people into choosing race as well as ethnicity, but still people who consider themselves or ourselves Hispanic often just check other.
Well, another thing that I've wondered about, and it certainly pertains, for example, to President Obama, if somebody has, say, a white mother and a black father, they're considered black.
Mm-hmm.
They're not considered white. Why
mm-hmm.
is that?
It's a historical artifact. And it's true in this country, but not necessarily true everywhere. So one of the things about race, as sociologists and race scholars understand it, is that it's a very malleable concept. And I have a good friend who was born and raised in the Bahamas, And he grew up as a white man. He went to schools that were legally, in some cases, designated as white schools. And he went to clubs where the people considered themselves and other people considered them white. And when he got to the U.S., his description of it is, he said, I stepped off a plane in New York and all of a sudden all these black people were calling me brother. And because in the United States, he's considered light-skinned black, right? And he ended up adopting that identity as in a kind of awkward way because he grew up as a white person. And he came to the United States, and especially on the U.S. East Coast, everybody viewed him as black. And so he became black, basically. Because he didn't have another category to live in and fit into. And those categories matter insofar as people act on them and they treat you certain ways because they view you as a member of a particular racial category. This kind of thing also comes up just between different parts of the United States, the continental United States. So I was once at a conference and I got I had some scientists come up and want to consult with me after a talk I gave on race, and their concern was that they were running a multi-site study, that is, a research project that was collecting data from people at around different parts of the United States. And they had observed when they were auditing their sites that people who considered themselves and identified as black on the East Coast, if you went to the West Coast, people who looked exactly like black people on the East Coast identified as white or Hispanic often on the West Coast. And so they were concerned that this might screw up their data somehow.
I can see where it would. As people become more mobile and there are more people, period, those categories just get farther and farther from any kind of clear definition, don't they?
Well, interestingly, it didn't take the contemporary mobile society to have those categories lose clear definition. So in the late 19th and early 20th century, anthropologists were going around measuring people, and they were doing very detailed measurements all over the world. They were measuring skin reflectometry and trying to understand sort of pigmentation and color. They were measuring, you know, length of different bones and relationship of parts of the face and facial features. And they were trying to come up with sort of objective measurements that would, from which they could create distinct racial categories. And what they discovered was the more people they measured and the more measurements they took, the less they could find distinct categories. And so by the sort of 1920s, anthropologists who were the scientists of the time who were studying race were basically saying there aren't distinct racial categories, that these categories are, physically speaking, biologically, the biology of its time was showing that those categories sort of merged into each other and that different features like skin color were continuous across the human species and the human populations. And, you know, skin color might vary from one group to the next. Leg length or height varies from one group to the next. They don't vary at the same rate necessarily, but they vary, and they vary in a kind of continuous way. And so the more measurements people took, the harder it was to define clear-cut categories. Whereas if you take a few people from one point on the globe, say, I don't know, South Africa, and a few people from Norway, you might look at those people and say, oh, they're really distinct, clear-cut differences and groups that these two fall into. But if you measure people across the globe, those distinctions tend to disappear.
I suppose that brings up the difference between a definition of race that is social or cultural versus something that is biological or medical. Can you give us some sense of, within the medical and scientific community right now, what does the word race mean and what kind of factual basis is there for it?
I could not say what the word race means in the scientific community because I don't think there's any agreement on that. Scientists and in the scientific community, really right now, I'm talking about the genetics and biology community because those are the communities I know. So first of all, I should just say, speaking of those communities and also speaking primarily of U.S. investigators, because of course, racial categories in the U.S. are different than the racial categories that people use in other countries. So with those two caveats, I would say that among biologists and geneticists. I don't necessarily think there's any agreement or clear cut. There's certainly no accepted definition of the word race. People use racial designators when they do their science sometimes. So they'll use categories like black, white, or Asian. They also use Hispanic as a separate category many times, even though it doesn't represent what anthropologists and even many population biologists would have thought of as something closely related to race. So what a lot of geneticists and population biologists tend to look at instead is they are thinking about sort of the history of human population movement around the planet and how frequencies of variations in DNA have shifted as people moved across the planet, how and why. So that's what they're interested in. And that relates to sort of ancestry to different continents, right? So there are times and ways in which some kind of common sense or folk notion of race is very closely related to things that geneticists care about. On the other hand, common sense and folk notions of race don't only take account of ancestry, not by any means. They really take account of a lot of other things, including skin color, which is related to ancestry, but certainly not identical to ancestry. So one of the things geneticists know is that skin pigmentation is very complex. There are many, many genes that control skin pigmentation. You can't go around the world, for instance, and say, we're going to categorize people into races by finding the skin pigmentation gene that makes some people white and some people browner and some people some other color, right? Doesn't work that way. Skin pigmentation, hair pigmentation, pigmentation generally is a very complex thing biologically.
If we really wanted to have a definition of race, could we do it that way?
That's hard for me to say. I think there are some people who would argue that you could, right? And so, for instance, Nicholas Wade of the New York Times has more or less argued that you could. The argument would be that there are very minor differences in the frequencies of a few genetic variants. And so across the world, if you look at all the genetic variants in a person's body and you look at a bunch of people in populations and you look at a bunch of populations around the world, you will see in some places, you'll see frequency differences in a population where some population has a little bit more of one genetic variant
right.
than another population does. So, and if you look at all of those frequency differences, the first thing to say is that humans are actually quite similar to each other when compared to other animals. We don't have a lot of genetic variation. We're a fairly young species. We evolved in Africa, and this is at least what the genetics tells us. We evolved, and what anthropology tells us, is that we evolved in Africa. We migrated out of Africa. We expanded fairly quickly when we migrated out of Africa. Only a small percentage of the overall genetic variation of the human population or the human species came out of Africa in those migrations. So there's a lot of human genetic variation in Africa, not so much outside of Africa in any population outside of Africa. But for the most part, because we all evolved together, we expanded rapidly, we haven't had that much time to develop a lot of genetic difference no matter where we lived in the world, right? So that's one thing that genetics tells us. And as I said, just as we see with physical sort of measurements of things like height and skin color, we saw that the variation between populations was gradual. You see that same thing with DNA variants and their frequencies in population, that from one population to another, if you go across the continent, the amount of genetic variation, or you go across the world, amount of genetic variation, you see a slow change in frequency. You start at one place and you move across geography. Genetic distance varies as geographic distance does. But at certain points, you see a small kind of discontinuity where the amount of genetic difference changes a little bit faster than geographic distance. And you see that where there are barriers to mating, basically.
Barriers to mating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so some of those barriers, the Sahara Desert was one, right?
That would be one.
So because it's hard for people to transit across that, Once people have gotten to the other side, they don't come back so much. There's not as much exchange back and forth across that. The Himalayan mountains were another one, right? Because they're very hard to cross. Once people have gotten across it, they were for a long time, or for, you know, enough generations, somewhat separated. And so you can see small discontinuities in terms of the amount of genetic variation that
between, say, the Indians and the Chinese, with the Himalayas in between, between North Africans and South Africans with the Sahara or Central Africans.
And what if you did a comparison? You mentioned a South African and a Norwegian,
mm-hmm.
and let's throw in an Ashkenazi Jew and a Native American from the Navajo Nation. If you did a genetic comparison, how significant is what on the surface to us over our history has made a lot of difference? You know, we tend in history to have persecuted and, you know, treated people very differently according to what we perceived was their difference. How much is that difference reflected in the actual genetics?
I'm not even sure how to answer that question. I could answer it by saying, well, the amount of difference is much less than you would see between two different groups of birds that scientists who, you know, population biologists who look at non-human organisms have a definition of races that has to do with certain amount of genetic distance between two populations of the same species. So that might be two populations of birds or fishes or whatever. The amount of difference between a group of people, a population from somewhere in Africa, and a Native American population, or a Finnish or Swedish population, it's not at so much that by the sort of traditional population biology definitions, it's not enough to be called different races, right? So, you know, but that's just a population biology definition. I mean, I guess significance depends on what you're looking at and what you care about, right? And so, of course, people who seem to be genetically very closely related to each other might still find cultural differences or physical differences that to them are very meaningful and cause them to, you know, have longstanding, or groups of people might find small differences that cause them to have longstanding animosity between those groups. So we make meaning out of very small differences sometimes. So it's, you know, I can't sort of answer the significance question in an abstract way. And interestingly, so this is one of the things. For geneticists, for instance, if they're trying to find medically important DNA variants, sometimes tiny, tiny, tiny differences in the overall genetic backgrounds of the people they're studying might really screw up some of the contemporary methods of trying to identify medically important DNA variants. So if they have study populations gathered from one city in Sweden and one city in Finland, they will use genetic techniques to try and find out, group those people by their overall genetic similarity, right? And they do that, and you can do that, right? You can find tiny little genetic discontinuities, if you will, or ways in which those two groups of people have slight amounts of genetic, overall genetic difference that you can capture using contemporary computational methods, right? And that can matter for scientists who are doing on these sort of genetic marker hunting expeditions. And so they do that. And they might also do that in a way that would separate out a group of people who, you know, would statistically cluster a group of people who come from somewhere in Nigeria and from a group of people who come from somewhere in Italy, right? You can also do that to separate out people in Iceland whose ancestors come from different counties in Iceland. So genetically, you can find teeny tiny overall differences in allele frequencies in groups, and you can categorize or cluster people based on those differences. Does that have significance anywhere else besides gene hunting? Maybe, maybe not.
You know? Do you see the technology that's been developed just recently as changing how we see race? I'm thinking in particular of how Henry Louis Gates and others have been part of this whole
right.
kind of tracing your roots
right.
back genetically and discovering to what extent are you black and white. And how is technology changing our view of race?
Yeah, that's not really very clear to me right now. And so I have to say that I have a certain amount of skepticism of some of the ancestry tracing that gets done. First of all, a lot of it doesn't look over whole genomes. It only looks at Y chromosomes and what's called mitochondrial DNA. So what you're tracing is a lineage of the father's 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 father, if you're male, looking at the Y chromosome, and a lineage of the mother's 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 mother, going back some number of generations, right? So you're not finding out nearly as much as, say, genome scientists typically find out when they're doing a study. You're only finding out a tiny sliver of your ancestry. And so when people do these genetic ancestry tracing kinds of activities, they need to know sort of how much of their ancestry they're really finding out about, or they might get a very skewed idea.
If you go back, say, 10 generations, you're talking about, 216 great-great, et cetera, grandfathers, equal number of grandmothers.
Right.
And if you trace
but
one of them, that's a thousandth of the story.
You're only finding yeah. one person mm-hmm. at each generation, right? If you go through the mother's mother's
right.
mother mother, right? You're only finding one person, and you're only seeing what you can see with genetics, which is not evidence of every single one of them necessarily, yeah. right? And so this is one of the things. It's genetic ancestry tracing that's related to but not the same as genealogy ancestry tracing for a lot of reasons. So, for instance, for a while in the early 2000s, one of the people who started one of these companies, he had put his kids' ancestries up there. And part of why he did that was to show that genetically his two biological children didn't look alike. I mean, they looked somewhat alike, right? But their proportions of ancestries to different continents varied by like 12 to 15%. And that's just because it's because of a lot of things. It's partly because we don't have maybe the ideal references to make the kinds of claims about where your ancestors came from. But it's also because of just the accidents of genetics, right? At every reproduction, you only inherit half of your mother's genes and half of your father's genes. And I and my sister or I and my brother, we don't inherit exactly the same half from the mother or the same half from the father. So even though we have all and exactly the same ancestors, we're not our genetic ancestry is not exactly alike. So that's interesting, but it can also be somewhat confusing. And how that may or may not affect those kinds of things may or may not affect our understandings of racial categories. Not clear how they can sometimes really sort of influence somebody's own understanding of themselves mm-hmm. and who they are and where they fit in the world. So people who grew up being told that they were Native American sometimes get back results saying, actually, we don't see any Native American ancestry here. We see some other ancestries here, right? And that it doesn't really change people's ideas of the racial categories, but it may change their idea of where they fit within those racial categories. Or it may not. You know, I think, you know, some proportion of white people in this country are going to come back with a certain proportion of relatively recent African ancestry. Is that going to change who they think they are? If in the world they've grown up white and everybody sees them as white and, you know, that's been the identity that they have forged over their lifetime? I don't know that it would change them that much, you know, in terms of their own self-conception of their position in a racial classification scheme.
Well, it's a complicated issue, and we're going to look further at it, at race and science and justice, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Pilar Osorio, who is filling us in about some of the latest discoveries having to do with what is race or if it even exists. And over the course of time, of course, race has been a major component of the way the law relates to people, especially in this country when it has to do with immigration, for example.
Yeah. And so law, of course, as a law professor, I'm always really interested in the ways that law both reflects contemporary social understandings and also helps to create or sustain social understandings and social relations. And so, of course, as long as there was de jure racial segregation and discrimination, so that means legally sanctioned, written into the law, racial discrimination and segregation, the law had to have – the law and legal institutions had to have ways of determining who was a member of what race. And this goes back to something you asked earlier about, you know, sort of has it become more difficult to categorize people? It turns out that, again, the law in the early 20th century was having some of the same difficulties that people still confront today. So when we had various kinds of Jim Crow laws, when we had racial prerequisites for naturalization in this country, and our law had – state laws had definitions of race, and federal law tended to just use words like white race, for instance. So there was a while when naturalization – to naturalize, you could naturalize as a free white person or a black person, but – strangely enough, everybody wanted to naturalize as a white person. So then the question was, who counted as a white person for purposes of naturalization? And people who tried to naturalize as white, some of them were Syrians, some of them were from India, some of them were from Mexico. Of course, people from China and Japan, all kinds of people tried to naturalize as white. And so the court system in this country, the federal court system, was constantly having to make determinations as to who counted as white. And the question was, what criteria did they use when the law simply said a free white person? And so the criteria that they tended to use were some mixture of common sense or folk understandings of race, along with scientific and anthropological, really scientific at that time meant anthropological understandings. So at a certain point in the early 20th century, there was a kind of crisis because anthropological understandings began to diverge from common sense understandings. Anthropological understandings, for instance, began to say things like, well, the people of India have common ancestry with the people of other parts of Europe. And so we think of sort of Indo-European, right, including or Eurasia. Right, as including the people of India, the people of the Middle East, with people of France and Germany and the Scandinavian countries. But that's not exactly how common sense understandings of race work. And so people from India were typically in kind of ordinary day-to-day interactions not really viewed as white people. And so courts had to decide, are people from India white? Well, and they came out all over the place, right? So there was a lot of conflict in the federal court system. Eventually, in the 1920s, there were two cases that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. One involved a Japanese man, Mr. Ozawa, who tried to naturalize as a white person. And he, interestingly, his argument was basically all about skin color. He went in and said, you know, the law says a free white person. And he came in with, in his briefs, data from anthropologists and other scientists who said things like, you know, the people of Japan have much whiter skin than other East Asians. People of Japan, when their skin is not exposed to the sun, have some of that pink tinge that typically white people view as their privilege. That is actually a direct quote, right? So he went into court and basically you could imagine him sort of standing up there holding his arm out, you know, next to a person widely acknowledged as white and saying, look, I'm as white as that person.
Or maybe whiter.
Or maybe whiter. So the court, the U.S. Supreme Court in Ozawa acknowledged that, you know, you can't really use skin color to determine race because people who are of the same race have quite a wide variation of skin colors. And among the white race, you have everything from the very light-colored Scandinavians to the swarthy Italians and Spaniards.
Right? The whole process seems so sad and absurd.
It does, doesn't it? Really well,
does.
It got maybe even more sad and absurd a few months later when the U.S. Supreme Court decided the next case. So the first case was Ozawa. And the court basically said that it was going to use some combination of scientific evidence and common sense notions of race. But in that case, anthropologists agreed with common sense notions of race that people from Asia were not necessarily of the same race as people from Europe, right? But then the next case was Finn.
Well, hold on. So Ozawa lost then?
So Ozawa lost.
And what was he trying to do?
He was trying to naturalize as a free white person.
And that's what he couldn't do.
And
then.
He lost, so he was not allowed to naturalize.
Okay. Because there were laws, especially on the West Coast, that would prescribe.
Well, this is federal law. This is federal law about mm-hmm. who can be a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the, so and the second
then
case?
The next case, just decided about 3 months later, was Thind. So Mr. Thind was, he was from India. And so here we have a divergence between the common sense understandings of race and the scientific of the time understandings of race, because people from India were viewed by anthropologists and are viewed essentially by geneticists today as having common ancestors with other people from Europe, right? And so, and in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court came down squarely on the side of common sense understandings of race. It completely jettisoned scientific understandings of race such as they were at the time and essentially said, everybody knows that people from India are not white people. And that when Congress wrote these laws saying that only free white people could naturalize, they meant not people from India. They were using a common sense understanding of who was going to be part of that in-group who could become a citizen of the United States. And people from India, regardless of their ancestry, don't count as white people. And I think, you know, one of the things that's pointed out is that race has never been just about ancestry. And it's never been just about skin color. And it's never been just about eye shape. It's an ideology. It's a set of practices that go far beyond any one of those things. And so while beliefs about ancestry are part of common sense notions about race, they don't determine common sense notions about race. And that's why I think no matter how much biological data we get about different people's ancestral histories, that's not going to give us clear definitions of race or better understandings of race necessarily, because our common sense, our practical ways of using that set of categories has only a little bit to do with ancestry, right? And so I think sometimes with the new genetic technologies, people want to be able to say, well, you know, if we just gather more data, then we can just get rid of all these problems about race.
A quantitative answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing subjective.
Yeah.
It's all in the numbers.
But that's really never going to happen. And part of the reason it's never going to happen is because race never was, and it still is not, just about ancestry or just about skin pigmentation. And I think a wonderful demonstration of this, it comes in a quote from a district court judge in Washington in 1921, in one of these naturalization cases. And he was trying to explain his idea about why there was a racial prerequisite in our federal laws on naturalization. Why did Congress care what race somebody was in order to let them naturalize? And he said, "It is obvious that the objection on the part of Congress is not due to color as color, but only to color as an evidence of a type of civilization which it characterizes. The yellow or bronze racial color is the hallmark of Oriental despotisms. It was deemed that subjects of these despotisms, with their fixed and ingrained pride in the type of their civilization, which works for its welfare by subordinating the individual to the personal authority of the sovereign as the embodiment of the state, were not fitted and suited to make for the success of a republican form of government. Hence, they were denied citizenship." I love that quote because I think that quote is really great evidence of how race, in this case, this guy is saying whiteness, as Congress used it as a sort of racial indicator, is not about skin color. It's not about genetics. It's not about ancestry. It's about a belief system, political affiliation, ideology, as much as it is about ancestry. And maybe ancestry relates to those things in some way, but here's what we really care about.
And would you say that writer was suggesting that it's just a matter of environment that the people have been raised in, or that something about them predisposes them
right.
to, you know, having this despotic
You know, I don't know that that writer was taking a position, but of course, from the time that racial categories came into use, they did carry with them not only sort of biological indicators, but also notions of characterological differences and emotional differences and differences in intellectual capacity. So the very earliest kind of naturalists' descriptions of different races from the 1700s, Linnaeus, for instance, who is, you know, sort of considered the father of taxonomy, scientific taxonomy, he created categories of races. And in his descriptions of different races, he had also ideas about people being lazy or prone to follow rules or not follow rules and things like that. So definitely from the very beginning, these categories were not only conceptualized as having biological traits, but also psychological and character traits. And they were, you know, race has always been about hierarchy, social hierarchy, where some group is superior to other groups.
So are there racial immigration quotas in this country?
Not anymore. So those ended in, you know, mid to sort of three-quarters way through the 20th century. So we don't have, you know, now our law doesn't use racial definitions so much.
Does it use national definitions?
We do have national definitions, yes. So we have, you know, quotas on how many people per year from certain countries can become U.S. citizens.
And what is that based on?
It's based on some political calculation, right?
So not kind of an implicit racial designation?
Well, you know, I guess you would have to ask yourself whether when Congress makes those determinations, whether members of Congress are operating under some implicit racial views or not. I can't say.
Race has always been an issue with education. Who gets to be educated? Who gets to be in the same school? That
yes.
sort of thing. Can you yes. talk a little bit about what that's meant in terms of segregation, the Brown case, and how someone in the South, for example, who was neither black nor white would have fit in with the Jim Crow rules?
So the Jim Crow rules, now this was state law, and so it varied state by state. And states had – there were a number of aspects of state law that had to do with race. So we had miscegenation laws, who could marry whom. We had the sort of Jim Crow laws about who could go to what school or eat in what restaurant or things like that. I believe that there were laws that excluded people, usually black people, from access to certain social services. And so in the South and in many parts of the country, a lot of those Jim Crow laws had to do with excluding blacks. In the Western United States, there were greaser laws and other laws that excluded Hispanics from various schools and social services and so forth. So those laws did have definitions in them of race. They varied from state to state. So for instance, in Alabama, in the early and mid-20th century, Alabama and Arkansas had the infamous one-drop rule. But other states like Florida had a rule.
One drop of blood, is that what you
so
mean?
So one drop of black blood makes you black, uh-huh. yes. And, you know, that kind of viewpoint still influences our racial thinking today. And that's why my friend from the Bahamas, who in the Bahamas is white, in the United States is light-skinned black and still treated and fit as a black person in this country, at least on the East Coast of this
country.
Well,
I have another version of that which I have seen is a country club that forbade anyone who had a black ancestor for the last 500 years would not be admitted to this club.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
How
so
you
that's,
would ever
that's private
that, I don't
often is private discrimination.
Right, right.
And then people can have any set of rules that they want to. And as you said, how they would figure that out, you know, is a whole separate question, right? Yeah, you know, so at any, you know, at in a particular year in this country, somebody might be black in one state and not black in the next state over, right? So you have Florida had the 1/8 Negro ancestry defines you as black. Georgia had a law that referred to any ascertainable non-white blood defined you as black, right? and I actually don't know. I haven't done the legal research to determine what ascertainable meant.
Right.
Right? Or who got to do the ascertaining. In Maryland, the law was that a person of Negro descent to the third generation, so looking three generations black, if you had anybody black in your ancestry, then you were considered black, right? So different states defined race different ways and perhaps defined it different ways even for different purposes. And there were interesting cases. For instance, California had some law having to do with access to schools at a certain point that just excluded black people. And so Asian and Mexican people wanted to go to white schools, basically. And the question was, under the law, were they – since the law only used categories of black or white, what were they? Well, it turned out anybody not white counts as black for purposes of certain laws at that time in California, right?
Including Japanese?
Yep. Anybody not white was black for purposes of that particular law. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's one of the fascinating things when, you know, as a race scholar, you talk about the contingency of race, how race is very fluid and it changes. Partly it changes on where you are, and partly that's because of the laws where you are. And so it is the case that somebody could have been white in Ohio and black in California, or white in Ohio and black in Alabama, for instance. You know, and the interesting thing is, you know, some people would say, yeah, but that's not really race, right? And that, you know, that's sort of an epiphenomenon. That's just social. It doesn't really, you know, get to the core of that person. But of course, it influenced your whole identity, right? It influenced what kind of education you got, what kind of health care you get, what neighborhood you get to live in. You know, we for, you know, many, many years in this country, in well into the 20th century, there were covenants. If you sold properties, you were, you know, by contract, handed down with the deed of the property, basically you were not allowed to sell it to people of certain races. So, yeah, those legal designations shaped your life in materially significant ways that could shape your health, shape the whole trajectory of your earning potential and your wealth and your offspring's wealth and all of those kinds of things.
We're going to look at health and other issues that overlap with race when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Pilar Osorio, and we are talking about race, science, and justice. Well, let's turn to the topic of health and medicine. Race sometimes gets to be a factor if we're talking about certain diseases, like sickle cell anemia or Tay-Sachs disease or diabetes. How important is it for race to be discussed when publishing a scientific study or for a physician meeting with a patient?
First of all, I just loved that question because that's the second time that – so when you say Tay-Sachs disease, what race are you thinking about?
It's more of an ethnicity, but my understanding would be that Jews were more predisposed to that genetic disease.
Okay. So now you've said two things that I think are really fascinating. So one thing is you said it's more of an ethnicity. Well, there is evidence of some restricted, you know, sort of mating historically – where people who identified as Ashkenazi Jewish or Northern European Jewish were more likely to have children with each other than people who didn't identify that way. And so there are some genetic variants that are more common in people who have ancestry going back to certain place in time in Northern Europe, right? Now, does that make those people a separate race? Or aren't they just white people, right? They are people of European ancestry whose ancestors emigrated out of Africa and up into Europe. And so I think one of the reasons that's a really important question is because a lot of times these questions about race, you know, if you think of race as somehow having ancestry to a particular continent, well, continents are huge. And within continents, there's a lot of genetic variation. Most of the genetic variation in the human population is found, like 95% of it, is found within the people of any one continent, right? And so that means a lot of what is medically important is in all of us, and certainly not spread out evenly among all the people of a certain racial group. And the Tay-Sachs example would be an example. Now, it's not only found in people of Ashkenazi Jewish origin at higher rates. It's also found in some other, I believe, in the Acadian population in the United States, who are mostly in Louisiana, who are descended from, I believe, French trappers. But I don't know all the details there, so I could be wrong. But that population in the United States also has very high rates of Tay-Sachs. So it's certainly not unique to people of Northern European Jewish descent. It is more common in that group, but not only in that group. And so if, for instance, physicians get it in their head that it's only that group that they need to be concerned about, then they can miss Tay-Sachs in other groups of people, right? Similarly, the example comes up, sickle cell disease in African Americans. And it's very interesting because the paper was just published this month, actually, looking at the rate of and the distribution of the genetic variant that causes sickle cell disease. And so that genetic variant is in its highest frequency in certain parts of Africa, but not all over Africa. So in parts of South Africa and northern parts of Northern Africa, you actually find it in as low a frequency as you find in Europe, which is almost none at all, right? So it's not that sickle cell alleles are African. They're found in particular parts of Africa, but not only in Africa. So the highest rates are found in certain parts of Africa, where as much as many as 15% of all the alleles of that gene are sickle cell alleles. But you get 12% rates in Greece, in Saudi Arabia, in Syria, and in a few other places around the globe. You get extremely high rates of carrying that allele, right? So it's not only an African condition, and it's not only a condition that's somehow naturally and necessarily associated with blackness. In Latin America, there are parts of the east coast of Latin America where about 5% of the alleles of that gene are the allele that causes sickle cell. So again, a doctor in the United States who has a lot of people of Latin American ancestry in that person's practice needs to know that there is sickle cell in Latin American populations and needs to be prepared to look for that. So it's actually not the case that diseases sort of are necessarily and intrinsically associated with certain races of people. They may be more prevalent, and it depends on. So in the United States, if a physician, for instance, serves a large African-American population, they may have more people with sickle cell in their patient population because most people in the United States who have recent African ancestry, their ancestors came from parts of Africa that had high rates of sickle cell. And that's why it's more prevalent here and more associated with African Americans. But, you know, there are Greek patients in the United States who have sickle cell. There are Latinos in the United States who have sickle cell. So doctors need to know that and to be careful not to associate particular inheritable diseases with just one particular race of people.
Let me get back to the mobility question then. With increased mobility and population flux, are some of these issues likely or more likely to gradually disappear than if populations remain static? I mean, because isn't it true that the bigger the gene pool, the healthier the population is likely to be?
Oh, I don't know about healthier. Those alleles are in the gene pool, right? And what it depends, really those things, for instance, sickle cell and some other conditions, some of them, like the alleles that cause sickle cell, we understand that they were selected for because having sickle cell trait, that is, having one version of the gene that could cause it and one that doesn't cause it, helps protect people from malaria and helps them to survive malaria infections better. So that trait was selected for. Once that selection pressure goes away, over time, that allele might go away from the population too, right, regardless of the size of the population. So it's not really about the size of a population. What is interesting, though, is that because there's much more sort of intermixing of groups that might have been temporarily separated or more separated, it's likely that our association of particular genetic risks with particular racial or ethnic groups will disappear over time. So, for instance, this idea that people of Northern European descent are at higher risk for certain conditions. Well, people of Northern European Jewish ancestry are marrying people of other ancestries at a very high rate. Over the last two generations, it's been 50% or greater, right? And so that means there are many people who certainly don't identify as Jewish, right, who are carrying those alleles that historically or, you know, for the last 20 or 30 years have been associated with having Northern European Jewish ancestry, which goes back to one of the other things you said when you said, well, you know, Jewish people have had a higher risk of such and such. It's really not because they're Jewish that they have had a higher rate of a higher risk for certain diseases. It's because they have a certain ancestry. And so one of the mistakes that happens, and I've actually seen this among friends of mine, is that a physician will not quite understand the relationship between a race or an ethnicity or some other categorical notion, won't quite understand why that might be relevant for knowing somebody's medical risk. So I have a good friend whose obstetrician asked her, "What religion are you?" And she thought he was perhaps asking her about her willingness to have an abortion, right? She does have Northern European Jewish ancestors, but what she said to him was, "I'm not religious." What he was actually trying to ask was whether he should do genetic tests that might indicate that her fetus would be at risk for certain conditions that might be inheritable. And in fact, what he should have asked her is, you know, do you have ancestors who were, you know, European Jewish, for instance? Or do you have ancestors who came from Greece? Or, that's the information that he really needed to decide what tests he should do. And he asked the wrong question and he got bad information, right? He got information that actually didn't help him to decide what prenatal tests he needed to do because he apparently didn't understand why he was asking the question to begin with, you know, and the connection of the category with the risk and the category of Jewish. It's not because a person's a member of a certain religion or culture or anything else. It's because they have certain ancestry that you might do certain prenatal genetic tests.
Well, so, it just shows how complicated the term race really is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things is it's not that race is always a bad category for scientists or doctors to use, but they really need to understand why they're using a racial or ethnic category. And often there will be a more discrete risk category that might be more useful than, you know, a racial or ethnic category, a racial category, which basically in sort of common use refers to, you know, ancestry to somewhere on a continent, as opposed to ancestry in a particular place in the world.
Our guest has been Pilar Osorio. Thanks for filling us in a little bit about race and its role in the legal system and in the healthcare system, too.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.